You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, everybody. This is Tobin Arthur, your host for Innovation for Alpha. And I am joined today by a really special guest, Dr. Raman Rafi, who is an advisor to AngelMD, has become a really trusted advisor, has got great insights. I'm really excited to learn a little bit more about Dr. Rafi today and his background. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tobin. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
You know, why don't we start off, just give some of your background, kind of, schooling, where you grew up, and maybe how you ended up in Michigan.
So I grew up in Los Angeles. I went to college at UCLA. I was very fortunate to go to UC Irvine for medical school. And while I actually went into medical school very open-minded, I remember during our second year of medical school, they actually did a survey on us asking what percent of us were interested in going into the geriatrics field. And in my class of 92, I think nobody was interested. And this was a big dilemma because they realized there's an aging population and they needed physicians taking care of this aging population. In my class of 92, I think we had 15 people go into anesthesiology, which was a school record. And we'll leave it at that. So while I was in medical school, my father was actually diagnosed with Parkinson's. And the reason why it's more significant is my father was actually a dentist, and we had immigrated to America. So he struggled for over a decade to get his California dental license. California is very difficult for every professional because it's a pretty saturated market, especially in Los Angeles. So he had difficulty getting his license. My brother actually became a dentist first and helped him get his license. But after struggling for 10 years, he got his license, he worked for 2 years, and then he got Parkinson's. So it was actually a big slap in the face. And to me, I considered myself very fortunate because I went to UCLA, I went to UC Irvine. I said, who else better to be a primary care doctor than a son of a dentist who got Parkinson's? And I didn't want to be a neurologist, even though I was a neuroscience major, because unfortunately, I'm aware that a lot of the patients with neurological diseases don't improve. And some of the neurology residencies, they actually ask candidates about that, that they're aware of that. But doing primary care, I felt I could have a bigger impact because I would be dealing with more populations than just people with neurological disorders. So anyways, I ended up in Michigan. I got a job as a primary care doctor for a company, which I will not name. And the company I worked for made house calls. And when I started with the company, it was a mom and pop company. It was a very small company. It was predominantly in the Midwest. And as time went on, the company got larger and larger and larger. And it ended up becoming the nation's largest house call practice. Subsequently, and so when I grew up in Southern California, I was very well of HMOs. Kaiser has a tremendous presence there. And coming here to the Midwest in Michigan, when I first came here, there was almost no HMOs. Kaiser has a very small footprint here. So when I joined this company, it was a mom and pop company. We were making house calls. And what they don't teach you in medical school or residency is that about 8% of Medicare's population cost Medicare 80% of their budget. And the healthy 80% of their population cost Medicare 20% of their budget. So for Medicare to really stay viable, they need to figure out how to take care of that unhealthy 8%. And that's basically the population that we targeted. 90% of the people that we were seeing were in that unhealthy 8%. These are the high utilizers. These are the people that do not have a primary care doctor. They utilize their emergency room for their primary care and their frequent flyers. So by providing primary care into the home and keeping them out of the hospital, we actually proved to Medicare that it's a much more cost-efficient model for providing primary care. So much so that we saved Medicare a ton of money. Nationally, there were, used to be 504 ACOs. And the company I worked for ended up becoming its own ACO because of its size. We had over 200 physicians across 8 different states. And our ACO was number 4 out of 504 ACOs. So we were in the top 1%. And part of that is because we were targeting such a neglected population. We were targeting people that were not getting continuity of care. And by providing primary care in the home, we proved to Medicare that's much more cost efficient. And actually in 2019, Medicare passed a law allowing any Medicare recipient to get a visiting doctor. You no longer had to be homebound. Prior to that, you had to be homebound. So people that have had neurological diseases or limited mobility would qualify for our services. After 2019, anyone with Medicare over the age of 65 would qualify for a visiting doctor. So when this company grew larger and larger, it actually grew the attention of insurance companies nationwide. And the seller ultimately decided to sell it to an insurance company who promised that they would not change the business too much. And that's what happened. And in 2020, COVID came and that changed everything. Because actually the company was owned by an insurance company, they were able to pivot seamlessly to doing telemedicine. The truth is, if the company had still been owned by the private owner, COVID would have put it out of business.
Oh, wow.
And this is a very, I dare say, rare example that the insurance company helped keep the doctor's group belly up.
Interesting.
Now, since then, things have changed. But here in Metro Detroit, when I first came here, some of the local hospitals were independent. Since then, and I'm not going to mention the names, but some of the local hospitals have been purchased by insurance companies. And I think this is a trend that we are seeing nationwide.
Interesting.
There are a lot of figures out there that 70% of physicians are employed, and the physicians who are not employed or work for themselves tend to work out of the system in the sense that they do a direct primary care, they do a cash-based business outside of the insurance-based system. And this is a difficult lesson that people might have to learn, because none of this is, at least when I went through medical school, it was not talked about. We were not educated on this, nor in residency. And I think there is some level of education about it now. And at the minimum, there is definitely more awareness as people like myself are talking about it more freely on podcasts and blogs out there. So it's more common knowledge.
There's a lot to unpack there. It's kind of worked backwards, because I want to come back actually to your choice in medical school, which is very interesting, very entrepreneurial in the sense that you kind of went where the market wasn't in some senses, but you were meeting the demand, this growing demand. But I don't want to get off the topic that you just talked about. So this, you mentioned the increase in employed physicians. How do you look at that? You know, is it good versus bad? One versus, you know, one direction is better than the other? Or what do you see that trend in terms of the impact to care, models that are effective, physicians operating in an employed environment versus an independent environment? What's your experience in all of that?
So that's a very good question. And I've thought about it a lot. And I think ultimately, to be honest with you, it depends on the market you work in. If you live in a big city, it's different than if you live in a rural area. In a rural area, you could be the only doctor in town and you can do well. In a bigger city where there's a lot more competition and more of a saturated market, you need to have more opportunities for physicians to be employed, because the truth of the matter is the overhead is going to be prohibitive for a doctor to be in practice. I don't think there are, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think there are many DPC doctors in Los Angeles, that you have more of a concierge practice, and that fits a certain niche, but it doesn't fit the general population. You know, the cost of doing business in California or Los Angeles is somewhat prohibitive. And from what I've seen, the doctors that do DPC are outside of Los Angeles, like in Santa Barbara.
Yep.
But the ones in Los Angeles, they're doing maybe concierge mixed with insurance-based.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then going back just a little bit further, you brought up some very interesting statistics as well about the impact on Medicare and really the health system overall, that there is a select audience of patients that are taking up and absorbing a lot of the resources. And I'm guessing a big portion of that is tied to chronic illnesses specifically. You know, talk a little bit about, and it's very interesting having the perspective of primary care and being more proactive about these things, these states, and like you said, not using the emergency room as their primary care, which is very expensive because it's not planned. It's, you know, all of the reasons, utilization, et cetera. But talk about your experience, you know, having proactive care and the ability to deliver and diagnose and work with patients in these chronic situations, and both from a macro perspective, where it's you know, reducing the impact, but also more specifically from a patient experience perspective, having, I assume, better care, better quality of life, better management of these diseases. Just what's your overall experience with that population that is absorbing, you know, 70-80% of the spend?
So preventive care is very important. Preventive care can't be overemphasized enough. I think it's very important that all doctors learn preventive care, but the majority of that preventive care falls on the shoulders of a primary care, which already has too many things on their shoulders, to be honest with you. Another aspect that nobody wants to talk about is, I think the population needs to be responsible for their own health and they need to take some responsibility. As physicians, with the shift to ACOs, which is accountable care, the doctors are being held accountable. There is a switch from a fee-for-service to a value-based service. And what that comes down to is the doctor is sharing the risk. Mm. It's really, in my opinion, not fair to the doctor, because the doctor can do their job. They can make all the right decisions, which in of itself is very difficult.
Right.
And at the end of the day, if the patient is non-compliant, the doctor is going to end up paying the price. And that's not fair.
Right.
And 5 years ago, before COVID came, I actually told my in-laws that I thought the entire healthcare system was going to collapse, because the reason I said that is I saw the incentives of the companies out there and how things were working. And in my opinion, I just did not think it was a sustainable model. And that's part of the problem of why healthcare was kept going up in the GDP of the country. It was unsustainable. And things like our company did helped bring it down, because we targeted that high-risk population.
Mm-hmm.
But like, as I mentioned, subsequently, this mom and pop company was bought by an insurance company, and their goal was, like in any business, to make money. And one of the reasons that did not work out, I can't really talk about it because I don't really know for sure. So I don't want to speculate on the podcast.
Fair enough.
But it's a dog-eat-dog business when other insurance companies compete with other insurance companies. Let's just leave it at that.
Right.
And so that goes back to, you know, doctors who can start their own practices and make it work. That's the best model of healthcare, and that's the best model for everybody internationally.
Mm.
I don't care if you're in Los Angeles, in Missouri, or if you're in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You're a well-known doctor. you are going to get people from all over the world come out to see you. And then you can decide if you're going to do a cash-based practice. You can charge what you want, where some days some physicians actually do accept cryptocurrencies nowadays.
Right.
And you can still choose to do charity care, which a lot of the more prominent doctors do.
Hmm.
Well, and you hit on something there. You mentioned concierge care. And like you said, it's still statistically somewhat of a niche audience. But one of the interesting things about the concierge model is that the physician has, like in an employed environment, they've got a guaranteed revenue stream. And so they're not concerned about fee for service. In other words, I only get paid when the patient comes in sick. It's reactive service, effectively. But now they've got a more holistic view, right? Their goal is to think about the patient, like you said, proactively, because they're incentivized to just have healthy patients that are happy patients, not just treat them. How do you think about that in the non-concierge environment? Because you mentioned patients have the responsibility overall in everything. And the physician can only make good decisions, but typically they're in a reactive mode. Patient's got something wrong. The physician typically, and you correct me if I'm wrong, there's very little compensation available in a fee-for-service model for anything that's proactive. So if they're doing it, they're doing it on their own time and their own dime, so to speak. How does the system, how do we get into a situation where healthcare is more proactive and preventative and the physicians are rewarded for that, not penalized for that?
Well, I think that's one thing the accountable care was doing. The accountable care was financially rewarding the physicians in part for keeping these patients out of the hospital.
Right.
Let's just say hypothetically, we save Medicare $1 million. The agreement was Medicare would share the savings, and that's what the shared savings plan was. Medicare would keep half and they would give half to the doctor. So that was a financial incentive to them. But that was also in of itself not financially sustainable. And I think that's where the switch to the value-based care is arising from. But even the value-based care, I'm not an expert, but it really hasn't been delineated what exactly it means. It's a term out there. But to my knowledge, there are no known parameters that the value-based is trying to hit or they're striving for. You know, Medicare has GPRO and HEDIS, these measures that they want the doctors, or as we're called, providers nowadays, to hit. And those have evidence behind them. GPRO and HEDIS have been proven to help make the patient population more healthy. What they don't account for, that it also causes burnout amongst the physicians because there's so much work for them to do in these EMRs that are not user-friendly.
Right.
Unfortunately, I think the physician is the last person they think about when they implement new rules in the healthcare system.
Yeah, they're just a cog in the system as far as so many of the folks running things think. So going back, continuing back a little bit further, knowing what you know now and kind of looking in hindsight, and it was, you know, it's a really cool background just in terms of how you got interested in this space and your father's story. What would you tell a medical student or somebody that's getting ready for residency? Happy about the choice? What should they be thinking about? You know, warnings, whatever. How would you be advising somebody who's not quite made up which decision they're going to go, you know, door A, B, or C?
To be honest, I would educate the physicians to learn to provide healthcare outside of the insurance-based system. Whether you're going to be direct primary care, if you're going to do functional medicine or lifestyle medicine, I think choosing to work outside the insurance-based system is the healthiest option from the physician's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
If you work with an insurance system, it becomes so regulated and so burdensome that I don't think you can be a solo practitioner. You have to join a group. You have to join a network. And that's the example of a cog in a system.
Right.
I think it's very important for physicians to try to stay independent, but it's very difficult.
Right.
I know myself, I don't think I could have done it out of residency because I had debt, and then, you know, I have a wife and kids to support.
Yep.
So even myself, I needed to have an employed position to get myself going. And I had intentions of doing my own brick and mortar practice. But as I learned the details of how things work, like I mentioned, I realized the way to make it work would be outside the insurance-based system. My recommendation is try to function, if possible, outside of the insurance-based system, because I think that's going to be the most viable system. There are some physicians in my generation who are trying to facilitate that. In particular, there is one who comes to mind. Her name is Leah Houston, who started the HPEC, which is Humanitarian Physician Empowerment Community, which is allowing physicians to have their identity decentralized from the system. And that allows people to be more mobile and work autonomously. So, but that has yet to pan out and yet to be proven, but I believe in that.
That makes sense. One more thought on this area. You mentioned going into as an employed physician, most physicians are coming out with a lot of debt, et cetera. I imagine it's probably difficult if they said, you know, I'm going to do this for 10 years, kind of get my feet under me, and then I'm going to split out and do my own thing once I've got, you know, a bit of a base. I imagine that sounds maybe good, but probably difficult to do, because once you're in the system, you're kind of in the system. Or do you find that there is an opportunity to jettison out and maybe go be independent once people have that experience under their belt?
There is an opportunity to jettison out. The problem is it really depends on the physician's circumstance. Chances are 10 years into the system, you're married and you have kids.
Right.
And whether you're the male or female provider or you're dual income providers, to a certain degree, you have these golden handcuffs on you.
Yeah.
But you can make it work outside of the system too. So I've seen physicians get out of the system and make their own practices after years of being in the system. My experience is most people that have worked in the system, if they want to get out, some go into the cash-based business, some just get out of healthcare altogether because they've had enough of direct patient care, or there's an entrepreneurial opportunity. Once you see all these inefficiencies in the system, if you really want to be entrepreneurial, then you can work with companies that design EMRs or design medical devices, and you can work as a consultant because you have a tremendous amount of knowledge, and you can provide tremendous value to these companies. And there are physicians doing that, and that's one of the, I think, target demographics of the AngelMD community is you provided an opportunity for physicians who want to do that, and that's one of the reasons that AngelMD is so successful.
That's a great segue, and I want to tie that to your personal thinking. As I mentioned earlier, you know, you want to go where the puck isn't as an entrepreneur. And so you're looking at, you know, your classmates, and a big chunk of them are going into anesthesia and so forth. And you decide to go the route of primary care, and you're looking at a geriatric patient or population that's growing. You know, very entrepreneurial, because the baby boomer generation is going to put continual and huge strain on the system. There's a lack of care for this audience. And so it's exploding. And you're right. You know, as in that mindset is the same mindset that says, how can I, as a physician, do things differently and improve care? And we just had a conversation on Friday. Our chief medical officer, Mark Freumson, was saying, every startup that contacts him, what they need are physicians to advise them, open up their networks, help them get, you know, legitimacy with whoever their patient base or client base is going to be, with industry in some cases, et cetera. And you're right, that's what we want to facilitate. So what's your experience been? You know, how have you been looking at, you know, new things out there. Like you said, could be EMRs, digital health, could be devices.
So we've done that. Yeah, there's half a dozen startups that have been in contact with me. I think some of them find me on LinkedIn, and then once you get on LinkedIn, it's a lot of networking. Mm-hmm. But people have reached out to me, and I've done advising for some of these startups just out of enjoyment. I actually enjoyed it because it also broke up the monotony of my day and patient care. Mm-hmm. And the reality is I knew exactly the target demographic that they were hitting. And, you know, some of them, I've been able to help them steer in the right direction. I felt they were going down the wrong fork in what they were doing. There was a company that was trying to help predict heart failure. And actually, that's, in my opinion, the future of healthcare as AI becomes integrated in healthcare. Mm. My opinion, AI's role is going to be more of a predictive role.
Sure.
So just as we were predicting and we were keeping the high utilizers out of the hospital, what AI is going to do is predict based on data who is going to be higher risk. Mm. And so this company was trying to predict heart failure patients before they have symptomatic exacerbations. And I educated them that, in my opinion, they were looking at the wrong parameters and told them different parameters to look at. And they agreed with me. And I mean, ultimately, I helped them go down. They still got to figure it out, but they were going down a dead end. Mm. And I put them more on a major boulevard. That major boulevard still has a lot of on-ramps and off-ramps, and time will tell what we'll figure out. But I confidently told people that they were going down the wrong on-ramp. The other thing I'll tell that I think is very interesting, as a physician, you know, I know things I know and I know things I don't know. And I have a certain level of confidence in when I know something. And when and if I'll see a physician myself or my family members, I'll ask the doctor and I'll ask them, and I emphasize that I'm not saying this in a rude manner. I want to know your level of confidence in saying what you're saying.
Right.
Because I know how medicine works. I know that the neurosurgeon has done so many cases of this, and that's why there are subspecialties within neurosurgery. And you know, when these doctors cite they have a 5% complication rate, how many of those doctors are actually measuring their own complication rate? Right. A lot of the times, these doctors are citing a study. And
right.
If you were not involved in the study, it doesn't really pertain to them.
Right.
And the general population does not realize that.
That's a whole interesting topic in and of itself, because yes. What you're hitting on is fascinating. There's a great book called Thinking in Bets, and it's a woman who's a professional poker player by background. And she talks about how all of life is about probability. You know, if I cross the street, I cross it confidently, knowing that there is a chance I'm going to get hit by a car. It might be a very low chance, which is why I'm crossing the street. And it's no different, as you're mentioning, in medicine. It's no different investing. And I don't know if you've watched the show Billions on Showtime. It's a great show. It's about a hedge fund. It's the characters are great, including Paul Giamatti, who's just one of the best character actors of this generation. And a lot of times you'll hear on the show the head hedge fund guy, and the, you know, there's a lot of great drama and so forth in the dialogue, but he'll ask his analysts, how certain are you? You know, because they're going to place a bet. And as you mentioned, it's the same thing. It's about probability. If the guy says, I am not uncertain, okay, we're going to make that bet. Or if they say, you know, it's a 30% chance, well, it's probably not worth putting $100 million into the 30% chance.
That's right.
But being honest about that, right? I think most people don't think about that statistic. That's super interesting. We ought to have a discussion about that or even a panel about that at one of our events, because I think it's...
That's a whole kind of worms in of itself I just opened up, because
it is.
I've seen so many physicians that just will cite a study. And
right.
I don't say anything, but if they're not part of that study, it doesn't pertain to them because that's not their complication rate.
That's right. And friends of mine, you know, you speak of neurosurgery in that space. They said, you know, one of the key questions for a patient and a family to ask, which they typically don't, is how many of these types of cases do you see in a given year? And, you know, that is the argument oftentimes for going to an academic institution, because they're seeing, in, you know, in certain cases, they're seeing lots of volume. And so they're presumably more proficient versus the community surgeon who maybe sees five of those particular cases a year. That's less optimal. This has been great. I really appreciate a chance just to get some of your thoughts. Very clever and insightful. It's great to have you involved in AngelMD. And I think the startups in our community are fortunate to have physicians like you who are insightful and willing to be helpful, involved. So really appreciate that and your time today. And I look forward to more coming in the future.
Thank you, Tobin. Same here. I look forward to it.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, Tobin.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by AngelMD Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.